just another day of defiance in Europe. Or is it? From APM, I'm Jeff Horwich. This is the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for Wednesday, September 26th. Coming up, we're going to visit California's first retail 3D printing shop. And if you tuned in yesterday to the podcast, I told you about a new paper showing that your potential may matter more than the things you've actually accomplished. Well, for whatever reason, we never played that for you, so we've got it for you today. It's very interesting. First up, though, feels like we have seen this before, and yet today's angry confrontations and tens of thousands on the streets in Spain and Greece come at a sensitive time. Spain has signaled it is close to asking for a bailout that will bring some harsh conditions for people used to a big spending government. And Greece is trying to find a way to adhere to the conditions it has already accepted. Journalist John Siropoulos is in Athens, and he's with me now. Hello, John.
Hello.
So what are you seeing? How does this compare with previous protests in Greece?
It's not the worst that's happened, but it had its fair share of violence. It was spread over a large area on Syntagma Square in front of Parliament. So there was the skirmish with police that one expects in these sorts of situations.
Are these ordinary people, or we've heard them referred to as anarchists who are causing a lot of the trouble?
Yes, the Greek phrase for them is the known unknowns, in a sort of Rumsfeldian turn of phrase. In other words, everybody knows about them, but no one really knows who they are, and they've never been identified or arrested and charged by police, which has led many to suspect that perhaps some of them are in cahoots with either the police forces or some of the political parties. But usually the sort of choreography of these things is that after the peaceful protest march has taken place and the political point has been made, then these people come in and take over and have their clashes with police.
The government of Prime Minister Antonis Samaras, many people hoped, would be able to thread the needle here between austerity and maintaining some degree of growth in Greece. Do protests like this signal that that government is just in the same boat as the government that came before?
Well, it is a very difficult position for the Conservatives to be in, because less than a year ago, they were the main opposition that was denouncing the bailout process and saying that austerity would lead Greece into a dead end. And over the course of the last year, they have been slowly co-opted into the government that champions these austerity packages and the bailout process that they accompany. So they've obviously shed supporters, they've obviously shed people to the radical left-wing Syriza, which now stands as the opposition opposing and denouncing the bailouts.
Journalist John Siropoulos with me from Athens. He blogs, by the way, at thenewathenian.com. John, thank you.
My pleasure.
And let's do the numbers. Some discontent on Wall Street as well, at least in the first hours of trading today. The Dow Industrials are down about a tenth of a percent. The S&P, on the other hand, down almost a third of a percent. And the NASDAQ, down the most of all, about seven-tenths percent in early trading. Stocks in Europe are ending a terrible day after giant protests rocked Madrid and Athens, as we mentioned. Continent-wide, stocks are down almost 2%. A main Spanish stock index, the IBEX 35, is down almost 4%. New home sales here in the U.S. fell a bit in August, but they're still sitting near two-year highs. New home prices, there we are, hit the highest point in 5 years. Also new this morning, applications for mortgages rose last week. That's thanks to interest rates plumbing record lows. Nicholas Ritsinas is director of Harvard's Joint Center for Housing Studies. Welcome back to Marketplace.
Good morning.
By this point, are we still worried about a housing slump at all?
I think we're worried. We're worried less and less every day. The data that comes out would lead us to believe that we are on the road to recovery. However, experience tells us there are still some potential potholes along the way in terms of the economy, foreclosures, but all the broad data seems to indicate we are well on a road toward recovery.
The U.S. housing recovery, as you say, seems steady, maybe is a good word for it. The jobs recovery, not so much. Is there any hope that a lift in housing can help people on the jobs front?
It could be. The more recent data indicates that new home builders are now back in the market again. Now, whether that's a strong enough engine to fully bring our economy back to a more robust level remains to be seen. But it looks like for the last year or so, housing is now a net positive for the economy, not a negative.
How about the values of people's homes? Does that change how they behave in other areas of economic life?
It does. There is the so-called wealth effect. And I think what we have seen in the past is one of the reasons that one of the byproducts of a fall in home prices is people think they have less equity in their home. And as a result, they're less likely to fix up their home. They get nervous about buying a new home because they think prices won't be there. So it has a debilitating effect on the psychology of both homeowners and potential homeowners.
Nicholas Retsinas with the Joint Center for Housing Studies at Harvard. Thank you.
Thank you.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
In recent years, Americans have been replacing their knees at a remarkable rate. A new study in the Journal of the American Medical Association finds total knee replacements have more than doubled in the past two decades. Around 600,000 of those are done each year. Peter Cram is at the University of Iowa's Carver College of Medicine. He crunched these numbers, and then he looked at what the knee surgery surge could mean for healthcare costs. Good to talk with you.
Thanks for having me.
So who's getting all of these new knees?
So our study focused on the U.S. Medicare population, and by our estimate, somewhere around 60% of all knee replacements are performed on Medicare beneficiaries, and our study focused on those people. So obviously the 40% of people who are getting knee replacements who do not have Medicare are not the focus of our work.
And just to drill a little deeper there, is it changing demographics? Is it an increasing demand for this surgery? What's happening that has caused that number to grow so rapidly?
Well, so our analysis really revealed two things. One is that we're doing more knee replacements because, quite simply, we are an aging society. And there are more people in Medicare in 2010 than there were in, say, 1991. The other part of the story is that there was a roughly doubling in the per capita utilization of knee replacement. What that means is on the same number of people, we are doing more knee replacements today as we were just 20 years ago.
Now, I'm not a doctor, but I have heard this conventional wisdom that's been out there that knee operations, in a sort of a general sense, might not always be backed by the best medical evidence, but people want to do them anyway. What's the latest sort of official medical verdict on procedures like this?
So knee replacement is, you know, an incredibly effective therapy. The problem is that the surgery is so good that we have hundreds of thousands of people a year who benefit from the surgery. And at $15,000 a pop, that adds up to real money, even by Washington, D.C. standards.
What are the implications for the medical system? Did you sort of cast things forward and look at financially what this means?
Well, so we are spending somewhere on the order of $9 billion a year on surgery for knee replacement. But remember, you could extend our findings to many other surgeries. And the fact is that this country has yet to come to terms with the fact that, yes, we have lots of incredibly good medical treatments that our hospitals can offer today. But the real issue is, how do we afford them? And that's something that we're still wrestling with.
Tough choices ahead. Dr. Peter Cram at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine. Thanks for your time.
Thanks so much. Have a good one.
One of the world's largest wind farms officially opened this week in eastern Oregon. 300 giant turbines spread over dozens of miles. But the announcement comes at an uncertain time for the wind industry, with a federal tax credit that's set to expire at the end of the year. From Oregon Public Broadcasting, here's David Nogueras.
John Audley is deputy director of the nonprofit Renewable Northwest Project. He says as far as wind projects go, the Shepherd's Flat Farm is an ambitious undertaking.
It is probably 2.5 to 3 times the size of good-sized wind farms. So this is a big wind farm.
The project's price tag was also big, just under $2 billion, about half of that coming from taxpayer subsidies. Now, some members of the Republican-controlled House want to end government support of green energy. This week, 47 congressmen penned a letter to Speaker John Boehner urging him to let the federal wind production tax credit expire at the end of this year. But that could have repercussions for the industry, says Renewable Northwest's John Audley.
It's important to note that the average wind turbine now is made from parts, about 60% of which are manufactured in the United States. And some U.S.-based companies boast as much as 80%.
The American Wind Energy Association points to a study that shows letting the tax credits lapse could cost the U.S. more than 37,000 jobs. In Bend, Oregon, I'm David Nogueras for Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
Most of us have printers at our disposal, but printing stuff in 3D, well, that sounds very Star Trek-y, doesn't it? But in fact, the technology has been around for a while, and it's now becoming an affordable tool for the masses. California recently got its first retail 3D printing shop, and we sent Marketplace tech reporter Queen Akim to check it out.
D's Maker sits in a mini mall in Pasadena. Inside, along the walls, sit about a half a dozen 3D printers. They're small rectangular machines, and a mechanical arm moves back and forth. Diego Porqueras is the owner. Tell me what we're looking at right now.
Right here, we're printing some keychains.
The printer is working off dimensions Porqueras fed a computer that's hooked up to it. But instead of putting ink on paper, this printer uses plastic. Porqueras points to a thick thread of plastic wrapped around a spool.
The physical printing itself starts at the spool.
That's a plastic?
Yeah, the plastic gets fed into the extruder.
By extruder, he means the tip of the mechanical arm, which looks like an extra fine pencil.
And there's a special motor that drives it into the hot end tip where it melts and then it extrudes it a very, very small, like 0.3 millimeter width.
Once the shape is outlined, the printer fills it in with layer upon layer of plastic. And about 10 minutes later, you get a three-dimensional plastic keychain. I lost a button. I can't find one anywhere. Could I bring it to you guys, and could you make me that button?
Yes, of course. Actually, it's pretty common to do that.
Right now, there are about a half a dozen 3D print shops like D's Maker around the country. They're mostly used by craftspeople making keychains and other tchotchkes. But the promise of 3D printing is much bigger.
It is a completely disruptive technology.
Ping Fu is the founder and CEO of Geomagic, a high-end 3D printing company in North Carolina. Among her achievements, Fu invented the 3D printing technology to make hearing aids, the kind that fit into the shape of your ear. She says, once upon a time, a highly skilled craftsman could make 8 such hearing aids a day.
Today, a high school dropout can print a few hundred of them at once.
Fu says in 5 years, she thinks we'll see 3D printers in department stores. If you can't find a pair of jeans, tennis shoes, or high heels that fit right, they'll be able to print one out for you. I'm Queen Akim for Marketplace.
If you're trying to get a job or just get ahead in this economy, there's some age-old wisdom that would seem to apply. Play up your accomplishments. Well, seems obvious, but maybe that's, in fact, not your best plan of attack. A recent paper from researchers at Stanford and Harvard sets out to show that potential for success is considerably more powerful than the things you have actually achieved. One author of the paper is Michael Norton, an associate professor at Harvard Business School. Good morning, Michael.
How are you?
I'm good, thanks. You ran a series of different experiments in this paper to explore this point, but for our purposes, tell me about the one featuring hypothetical job applicants. How did that work?
So we actually literally looked at a job situation where one person who applied for the job was very well qualified and had experience in things, but had scored very highly on what we called a leadership achievement test.
Okay.
Another candidate for the job, very highly qualified, lots of experience, had scored very highly on a leadership aptitude test. And that was the only difference between these two candidates. People actually prefer the candidate that did well on the aptitude test, what they could be capable of in the future, much more than the person who already achieved those things.
Well, what are your thoughts on why, over your whole series of experiments, many of us will tend to favor a gamble on potential over something or someone with a proven track record?
You can think about it a little bit like people's love of scratch tickets, where you have a dollar in your pocket, and a dollar in your pocket is great, but if you could get that scratch ticket, you could have $5 million. And in some sense, that's what people do when they're hiring and evaluating other people. And it's almost like rolling the dice. You say, let's take a gamble. You don't focus on the fact that the person might be a disaster. You focus on the fact that they might be a superstar.
So putting aside whether that is actually wise thinking, let's think about all those people out there fighting for too few jobs in this economy we have right now. What kind of advice would your study seem to imply for them?
You know, I think that all of us have a tendency to say all the things that we've done. But it's a little bit boring. What we want in people sometimes is this vagueness or this ambiguity, at least for a little while, that they might be some kind of superstar beyond our wildest expectations. And if you think about your resume, resumes are usually a list of all the things that we've done. It can be wise to leave some ambiguity for people to read into you what they will.
And when you go into that interview, hype your potential.
That's right.
How good you could be.
And of course, it can be awkward to do that yourself, but one way to do it is in your reference letter. So encourage your recommenders to say, not only is, you know, Mike a solid candidate and he's done good work, but I have this belief that in the future he has enormous potential to do amazing things, even beyond what he's done now.
News you can use. Very interesting. Michael Norton is an associate professor at Harvard Business School, also has a book coming out soon. It's called Happy Money, The Science of Smarter Spending. Michael, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Can't help dipping into the sports news of the week before we wrap up here. The notorious touchdown that ended Monday night's football game has made for a rare point of agreement in the presidential race. Now, you can only ask so many boring questions about deficits and jobs, apparently. So, of course, reporters wanted to know what Romney and Obama thought of it. Quick recap. The NFL's union referees are locked out in a labor dispute, and replacement refs handed the Packers-Seahawks game on Monday to Seattle with a dubious last-minute call, let's say. CNN caught up with Mitt Romney somewhere on an airport tarmac.
I'd sure like to see some experienced referees with NFL experience come back out of the NFL playing fields.
And President Obama agreed. He said on his way out of the United Nations that the call was terrible and the real refs needed to get back to work. Now, Paul Ryan used the call to score his own political points, suggesting that refs with such poor judgment must work part-time in the president's budget office. Ryan, of course, is from Wisconsin, Packers fan, so we have to cut him a little bit of slack if he's angry. If you missed Marketplace's nifty analysis of the cost of a bad call in the NFL, check that out at marketplace.org. And finally, to a crackling international debate in the bacon industry. It started when the British National Pig Association warned of an unavoidable world bacon shortage. The worldwide drought has sent corn and soybean prices through the roof. Pricier pig feed, fewer pigs, right? Well, the British announcement was answered promptly and quite passionately by the Canadian Swine Exporters Association, which reassures Canadians, at least, that there will be plenty of bacon to go around. Will Canada start hoarding its bacon if the rest of us come up short? I smell a trade war. That's all for the Marketplace Midday Update. I'm Jeff Horwich, coming to you from 8 p.m. American Public Media.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's a speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.